welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. It was a time and place ridden with civil war and assassination. It was 1st century B.C. Rome, and the names of those involved are well known to us. They included Julius Caesar, Pompey, Brutus, Antony, and Cleopatra. Perhaps less well known, but still fairly familiar to us, is the name Cicero. Neither a soldier nor a ruler, he was a master politician, and he's the subject of our interview this week with Anthony Everett. And following our visit with Mr. Everett, Robin Marantz-Hennig will join us to point to some parallels in popular reaction to in vitro fertilization, test tube babies, in the 1970s and cloning today. But first, Joey Skidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on February 12, 1912, Pu Yi, the last emperor of China, was forced to abdicate when Republican revolutionaries occupied Beijing. Pu Yi, only 6 years old at the time, was guaranteed his title, safety, and income, and his family and advisors were permitted to remain within the Forbidden City. Pu Yi continued to live in the imperial palace until 1924, when warfare between warlords grew to a climax, his imperial title was abolished, and he was sent into exile. He sought asylum from the Japanese, living in the Japanese-occupied territory of Tianjin. In 1931, Japan occupied the province of Manchuria and created a puppet state under Pu Yi's rule. He reigned throughout World War II, but upon Japanese surrender, he was captured by Soviet troops and imprisoned in Siberia. He remained in Siberia until 1959, when he returned to China and was granted citizenship of the Republic of China.
Turning to an item of historical interest in the news, a little-discussed theory of the American presidency has had startling, if unnoticed, success as a crystal ball. Stephen Skowronek is the author of The Politics Presidents Make, published in 1997, which is a revision of his 1993 book with the same title. The books, some believe, have foretold such major events as Bill Clinton's impeachment and George W. Bush's drive for a second Gulf War. Okay, maybe he never said it in print, his boosters allow, but if you follow his theories, they insist it was all predictable. The predictive strength of Skowronek's work are rooted in a scheme for classifying presidents and their impact on American politics that assumes two things. First, presidents are elected against the backdrop of what Skowronek calls a regime. In other words, they don't start history anew the day they walk into the Oval Office. A lot of their job has been defined beforehand. His second assumption is that affiliation with or repudiation of the preceding regime comes from the incoming president's party identity. New presidents from a party that has been in office generally continues its policies, or at least they don't repudiate them. New presidents from a party out of power generally repudiate the rival party's regime and call the country to a new covenant or new deal. And even if they're not particularly successful in realizing their new deal, by their repudiation of the past, they will be hailed as great innovators. This is Talking History. Politics has never been more chaotic than it was in Rome in the 1st century B.C. with all of its power brokering and corruption, and when that failed, assassination. And the most masterful politician of the day was Tullius Cicero. Perhaps because he lived in the shadow of giants like Caesar and Antony, we know little about Cicero. But we now know much more thanks to a new biography authored by our guest this week, Anthony Everett, who is interviewed by Talking History's Eileen Dugan.
Rome in the 1st century B.C. was a tumultuous place, brimming with civil war, assassinations, street fights, and Roman armies marching on the city itself. It was also a time of towering historical figures of Julius Caesar, Pompey the Great, Marcus Brutus, Octavian, Antony and Cleopatra, and Cicero. Although a mere politician in an age of war, the name of Marcus Tullius Cicero remains one of the most familiar from ancient times. The name may be familiar to us, but is the man? Who was Cicero, and how did he come to play such a pivotal role in the fall of the Roman Republic? With us today to explore the political world of ancient Rome is Mr. Anthony Everett, author of the new biography Cicero, The Life and Times of Rome's Greatest Politician. Hello, Mr. Everett.
Hi, very good to talk to you.
Why did you undertake writing a book about Cicero in the first place?
Well, I know it is a bit of an odd subject in a funny way, but I'll tell you why. There are two reasons. A few years ago, I used to go to Rome in Italy in the summer, every summer, for a theatre festival. That took up my evenings. I had nothing to do in the daytime. And I started wandering around the Roman Forum and looking into it in considerable detail, trying to work out where everything happened. I got so fascinated, I thought, how could one bring the Forum back to life? And I thought of Cicero, because this great politician of ancient Rome, everything important that happened in his life took place in this small piazza, hardly larger than a football pitch. So that was the first reason. The second reason was Cicero left behind 900 private letters, well, some public, but a lot of them private, to his dear friend Atticus. And they give a unique insight into this spectacular story of the collapse of the Roman Republic through the eyes of somebody. You can see events happening from day to day through the eyes of someone who doesn't know what's going to happen next. You can write a life of Cicero in a way that you can't write a life of any other ancient classical figure, because there's so much we see things through his eyes. It's as if one's writing a life of, a 19th century politician.
What is the standard interpretation of Cicero? I mean, do we look upon him positively or negatively?
Rather negative, I'm afraid. I mean, he was the bane of schoolboys and schoolgirls in the days when we all studied Latin. Those days, of course, are sadly passing, because we all had to study his terrible, long, boring architectonic speeches. And so that's a barrier, really, to get across. And the second thing I think that's a problem about Cicero is that he built up a reputation in his lifetime, and it was built on by later historians, of being somebody who couldn't make up his mind, of being a vacillator, of being on one side at one minute, another side the next minute, and so forth. I say this is a really unfair reputation, and I think it derives from the fact that we happen to have had his letters. If you have the private letters of any great politician or statesman, it will look as though, going from day to day, they can't quite make up their minds. We would have a very different idea of Julius Caesar if we had his private correspondence.
That's very true. How would you describe Rome and Roman politics in the first century BC in Cicero's time?
Well, Rome was an extraordinary place. There were probably about 1 million people living there. There was no town planning. There were none of the ordinary sort of things you expect for the management of a great metropolis, and indeed for the management of an empire. I mean, there were no great avenues. The whole place was rather like an enormous kasbah in northern Africa with tiny little streets and so forth. This meant that it was extremely difficult to control politically. There was no civil service. There was no fire service. There were no police. There were no banks in any sort of proper modern sort of sense. So none of the basic supports for civilized life existed, and yet somehow they managed to. Because whereas all that is true and the whole thing sounds like a terrible sort of a mass of confusion, life could be very civilized. The well-off had country villas. People went to dinner parties. There was a very lively artistic life. Everybody talked about the latest book. So ancient Rome is a combination of, from our perspective, 2,000 or so years later, the very familiar and the extraordinarily strange.
And what of politics in that time?
Politics was a kind of free-for-all. This was a republic, and it was a republic essentially dominated by an oligarchy of 20 or 30 great families. They all competed equally. They were all furiously jealous of each other, and nobody should be allowed to achieve a real mastery or a real dominance. This was reinforced by the way in which politics was actually structured. You didn't have a prime minister or a president. What you had was each year, for 12 months only, two consuls, two equal men at the top of the state. They had complete power while they were in office, but they could be they could be sued, taken to court for illegalities after they left office. Each of the two consuls could veto anything the other consul wanted to do. There was a whole set of people, 10 tribunes of the people. Their role, these officials' role, was to protect the interest of the masses as distinct from the oligarchy and the great aristocratic families. They could veto anything that any of the consuls did. Now, when you begin to think of this political system, I mean, how could they organize a cup of coffee, let alone manage an empire?
That's very true. And things seem to get worse in the first century BC in terms of political violence. And why does that happen?
I think it happens for two reasons. First of all, the armies became professionalized instead of being militias raised from local Italians up and down the peninsula. And these professionalized armies developed direct loyalty to their generals. And so the generals, who were also politicians, had very, very considerable power, and they used their armies against each other. I think the other thing that happened was the empire was just getting too complicated for this extraordinarily cumbersome political mechanism actually to manage. And through the last years of the Republic, a succession of reformers emerged, saying, look, this is ridiculous. There must be another way. Now, most of those reformers were knocked down one way or another or only lasted short periods of time. But the greatest of these reformers, with his dash and his flair, of course, was Julius Caesar.
How did Cicero enter into the world of politics in this period?
Well, you see, he wasn't really quite a Roman. I mean, he was a bit kind of infidic. He was a bit kind. He was what they called a new man, an arriviste, the French would say. He came from a small town south of Rome. He got into Roman politics, although he didn't belong to one of these great families, simply by his talents. And his main talent was public speaking. He had the most golden tongue. And public speaking was hugely important in Rome, partly for running the legal system. He was a great advocate, mainly defending people, but also for meetings of the Senate and trying to persuade public meetings to take certain courses of action. So public speaking was really, really important, oratory, and he was just simply a very great orator. So that's how he got underway, and he made a great reputation for himself when he became consul, discovering and putting down a rather dangerous conspiracy. And so there he was at the head of affairs. However, despite his criticism of the Republic, he was actually very loyal to it. He was really a traditionalist. All the problems of Rome could be solved by going back to the good old days, to the good old customs. He couldn't see with that merciless clarity that Julius Caesar could, that actually the Republic was a busted flush and it was time to think of something new. So his strength was he was a moderate conservative. His weakness was he didn't have quite that insight of genius that presaged a revolutionary change.
One of my favorite images actually from Cicero as consul is wearing the breastplate of the military breastplate of all things and delivering the speech against Catiline. How did that really put him on the map?
Well, I mean, the extraordinary thing about Cicero's career is that an ancient Roman, to be a great success in life, you had to be a soldier as well as a politician. You had to be military as well as civilian. And Cicero loathed aggression. Whether he was a physical coward or not, one can't really quite tell, but he just loathed physical aggression. He did his best to avoid military service. He did a little bit of it in his teens and really did not enjoy commanding armies. And so he got a bit of a reputation for being a physical coward, and so people were rather amused when he wore this breastplate and all the rest of it. But his career is remarkable for the fact that he got right to the top without having this military background.
What do we know about Cicero's private life?
Well, quite a lot, but in sort of bits and pieces. There are holes here and there. He married a woman called Terentia, who brought quite a bit of property with her. She sounds like a very sort of businesslike woman. It was a sort of marriage convenience, as most marriages were then. And she saw herself very much as a politician's wife. And she was a great sort of support to him. I think a bit of a shrew, a bit of a busybody, not a very easy person to live with. Cicero had a brother called Quintus, all quite able, a younger brother, but very much in Cicero's shadow. And Cicero was always telling Quintus what to do and to help him to do this and help him to do that. And Quintus more or less did what he was told for most of the time, but eventually the worm turned at the end of the Civil War when Quintus realized that his brother had chosen the wrong side, the side against Julius Caesar, the victor, and they were all going to get into great trouble. There was a massive row, and Quintus and his rather unpleasant young son stalked off, and the family really didn't quite recover from that, although there were attempts at reconciliation. The person that Cicero really adored was his daughter Tullia, and the greatest tragedy in his life was when, as a young woman, she died in childbirth. And it was an overwhelming defeat. It was quite the most terrible thing in his life. He had had political disaster, political catastrophe, but nothing hit him like the death of his daughter.
How did Cicero choose sides in the civil wars between Caesar and Pompey and Antony and Octavian?
With very great difficulty. It's not that he was a vacillator, but he always had one. What he wanted to do was a return to the good old days of when the Republic worked, a balance between the Senate and the people in the popular assemblies. And so he would always make a judgment at any given moment as to what was most likely to achieve that political objective. He was very fond of Caesar personally. They got on terribly well. They were both very good writers, and they delighted to talk together on literary sort of topics. But Cicero seriously disapproved of what he saw as Caesar's total irresponsibility. And although he was much too much of a gossip to be allowed in on the conspiracy to kill Caesar, you really couldn't trust him. There's nothing. Cicero could resist anything but a good joke. And he was always getting into trouble for making waspish remarks about people. And so he wasn't let into the secret of the conspiracy. But when Julius Caesar was struck down in front of Pompey the Great statue on the Ides of March, Cicero was sitting there in the front row of the Senate meeting. He was delighted. He was absolutely delighted. And in the last 2 years of his life, he fought bravely, although finally ineffectually, tragically, to retrieve the Republic and to stop the arrival of the impending empire which replaced the Republic. Octavian, the young Octavian, the adopted son of Julius Caesar, only 18 but formidably competent, was in fact to succeed where Julius Caesar had failed. He established the Roman Empire in the form that we know it, headed by a permanent emperor in place. And it was he with Mark Antony who arranged that Cicero should be put to death.
We only have a few moments remaining, but just to ask one final question. How do you think Cicero would fare as a 21st century politician? Would he be able to move in politics today?
Well, he knew all about dinner parties and how to win friends and influence people. He'd be quite good at that. He knew all about spin. In fact, I think he invented spin. I think also today's world, certainly from an American perspective, is not all that dissimilar to the world of Rome in the first century BC, because in both cases we have a republic having to run an empire and finding it rather difficult. The American empire is a very different sort of empire, but nonetheless many of the issues are similar. For example, both in the first century BC and today, the Middle East was always a problem, as much for Rome in those days as for Washington today. And there were Osama bin Ladens and there were Saddam Husseins in the Middle East in those days that were creating trouble for Rome. He would recognize quite a lot of today's world.
Including the scandals.
Oh, loads of scandals. Of course, Romans are slightly more tolerant about scandals than some modern countries. I think Romans was a bit more like France in that respect. I mean, people were expected to have a good scandal.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Everett.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Mr. Anthony Everett, author of Cicero, The Life and Times of Rome's Greatest Politician.
Thank you.
the objections to human cloning are virtual copies of arguments made against in vitro fertilization a quarter century ago, reports Robin Marantz Hennig in the Scientific American. Hennig is the author of Pandora's Baby, How the First Test Tube Babies Sparked the Reproductive Revolution, and she joins us to explain her remarks for our commentary of the week.
Remember Louise Brown? She was the world's first test tube baby, and she turned 25 last summer. You might remember her name. You might remember that she was British. You might even remember that her doctors, Steptoe and Edwards, sounded like an old-fashioned vaudeville team. But what you probably don't remember is how frightening it was to wait for her birth. Those who were paying attention were sure that the world's first test tube baby would be abnormal, genetically deformed, less than human, monstrous, and at the very least a freak of nature who would have to grow up with the eyes of the world charting its every move. Amazingly, Louise was pink and perfect, normal in every way. When she arrived just before midnight on July 25th with 10 fingers and 10 toes, she was living proof that lab manipulations didn't have to hurt the embryo. The age of assisted reproduction had begun. The fears that preceded Louise's birth from in vitro fertilization, or IVF, are similar to today's fears about other reproductive technologies. In fact, some of the voices raised in opposition to today's techniques, especially cloning and designer babies, are the same voices raised a generation ago in opposition to IVF. And some of these voices are saying the same things now that they were saying in the 70s. But even if the players and the rhetoric are the same, the situation is not. We are, it seems, on the verge of learning the wrong lessons from the IVF experience, bending too far in the direction of overregulation because we have seen with IVF the unfortunate results of not regulating enough. Back in the 70s, some of IVF's opponents predicted that it would cause the nuclear family to collapse. Well, they were wrong. If anything, fertility treatments have enhanced the nuclear family, not damaged it. But one prediction did turn out to be true. Some people said IVF would be the first step down a slippery slope toward techniques that were even more bizarre. And they were right. We wouldn't be talking about any of the things that are now possible if scientists had not first figured out how to fertilize human eggs in a petri dish. And some of the things we're talking about now are strange indeed. Last summer, a scientist from the U.S. said he had successfully inserted cells from a male embryo into an early-stage female embryo, creating a mixed-gender hybrid that some journalists were calling a she-male. At the same time, scientists from Israel and the Netherlands described research that I think was even weirder. They harvested eggs from aborted fetuses and cultured the eggs so they could eventually be used in IVF, which would thereby create a baby with a biological mother who not only was no longer alive, but who had never even been born. No one could be talking now about such things if the techniques of IVF hadn't been perfected over the past 25 years. Maneuvers like these begin with the same steps used for in vitro fertilization: extraction of the eggs and sperm, fertilization in a petri dish, culture of the embryo until it reaches a certain stage, implantation into a receptive uterus. Of the embryo manipulations that are now causing so much controversy, cloning, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, gene enhancement, culturing human embryos for their stem cells, none is possible without the techniques of basic IVF. But the slippery slope argument must not be allowed to dictate science policy. It's a mistake to regulate something now based on fears about what might happen later. One thing does lead to another in science, as it does in so much of life, but that doesn't mean the progression is inevitable. If a slippery slope exists in reproductive technology, that's no reason to keep from learning as much as we can as soon as we can learn it. Instead, I think of it as a reason to monitor how certain discoveries evolve, so that we, as a society, can put on the brakes when it's time to say enough.
And finally, we leave you with the words from the past never intended to be heard by you. Americans were electrified at the moment in 1973 when, amidst the Watergate affair, they learned that President Nixon had secretly recorded his Oval Office conversations and that other presidents had done the same. A collection of those recordings has been gathered and offered to the public by the New Press, and we have permission to play some of them for you. This week we take you back to October 4, 1940, in a White House meeting between President Franklin Roosevelt, House Speaker Sam Rayburn, and Representative John McCormick. The meeting took place during the early months of World War II. The United States was not in the war yet, and Roosevelt had campaigned on the platform that he would keep us out of war. But he'd committed the nation to being the arsenal of democracy, as he put it, whose weapons and munitions would help Great Britain defeat Germany. In this brief clip from that conversation, the president talks about how he would respond if Germany, Italy, or Japan, all allies, charged the U.S. with an act of war and sent him an ultimatum. Listen carefully, maybe turn up the volume a bit. Remember, this was recorded in the Oval Office over 60 years ago and never intended to be played on the radio.
And you see, well, hell, I haven't always spoken frank about these things. The Prime Minister of Japan has just given out an interview, which may or may not be true, but he may deny it this afternoon, to the Swiss Hollow of the INS papers, in which he says that Japan would regard it as an act of war if we were to give aid and comfort to any of the enemies of Japan. Now, what do you mean? What does the word attack mean? I don't know. It's perfectly possible, not the least bit probable. I mean, it's a, Jack Brown would say, it's a 1 in 10 shot, that Hitler and Mussolini and Japan tonight might feel that if they could stop American munitions from flowing to England, planes, guns, aircraft, guns, ammunition, and so forth, that they could lick England. Now, they might send us an ultimatum. If you continue to send anything to England, we will regard that as an attack on us. I say, I'm terribly sorry. We don't want any war with you. We have contracts. And under our neutrality laws, any belligerent has the right to come and buy things in this country and take them away. They thereupon say, well, if after such and such a date you are continuing to ship munitions to England and planes, we will regard you as a belligerent. Well, now, what have we got to say on that? They have called turn, I say, I'm terribly sorry. We don't consider ourselves a belligerent. We're not going to declare war on you. If you regard us as a belligerent, well, rightfully so, but we don't. Now, all we can say to you is that, of course, if you act on that assumption that we're a belligerent and make any kind of attack on us, we're going to defend our own. Not war, we're going to defend our own, and nothing further.
You've been eavesdropping on President Franklin Roosevelt in an Oval Office conversation in 1940, and that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Joey Skidmore, producer, Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. Visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.